From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. After months of being cooped up indoors to stop the spread of a deadly virus, hundreds of thousands of Americans have flocked to the streets of U.S. cities over the past 10 days to protest police killings of Black Americans. While many are wearing masks while they protest, public health officials worry that the gatherings may undo the work of curbing COVID-19 infections. Others say the protests are necessary in spite of the pandemic because of the threat of racist and violent policing to public health. It has been nearly 4 months since the global coronavirus pandemic was declared. While there has been a glut of data and research, there has also been tremendous misinformation in the public sphere. From time to time, we've turned to Professor Lawrence Gostin to help us understand the latest reliable information on COVID-19. He now joins us once more. Professor Gostin is a university professor at Georgetown University, where he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. He's also the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law, where he served in numerous high-level capacities. He co-chairs the Lancet Commission on Global Health Law and serves on two global commissions to report on the lessons learned from the 2015 West Africa Ebola epidemic. Welcome back to the program, Professor Gostin.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Where do you fall on the issue of the protests? As somebody who is deeply concerned about the spread of infectious diseases, how do you feel seeing these images of people gathered in the hundreds of thousands around U.S. cities?
Well, I'm torn, to be very honest with you, because, you know, I believe very fervently in public health and health and safety, but I also believe equally fervently about justice and of all the kinds of injustice, you know, health injustice and racial injustice are the worst kinds of injustice, as Martin Luther King said. And so it's reassuring to me as an American to see people care so passionately and protest. But I also worry, and I worry a great deal, that this is going to amplify the COVID pandemic. And even if many people, if not most people who are protesting are young, they will be going back to their parents, their grandparents, they'll be in their communities. And so this is clearly a risk of to amplify a very deadly disease.
This week, there was a letter signed on to by more than 1,200 public health professionals, infectious disease professionals, and community stakeholders that highlighted, of course, the dangers, but also said that white supremacy is a lethal public health issue that predates and contributes to COVID-19. They did give a number of ways in which protesters can keep themselves safe, in addition to trying to avoid tear gas. We're now hearing that the use of tear gas in particular, which unfortunately our police forces have unleashed on even peaceful protesters, is found to make people more vulnerable to the kind of respiratory ailments linked to COVID-19, right?
Well, they are. I mean, normally we associate, high risk with, pre-existing chronic conditions like asthma or emphysema, things like that, that are respiratory diseases. So we don't have a lot of good data about tear gas, but let's just put it this way. Tear gas affects, breathing. It's quite toxic. It should never be used on peaceful protesters, whether or not we have COVID, but particularly because COVID is pre-existing. I fear for America. In all my lifetime, I've never quite seen it unravel in the way it is now. And we're facing a triple threat. On the one hand, we've got COVID with over 100,000 deaths and more to come, many more to come. Mm. On the other, we've got, deep-seated, ingrained racial injustice and health inequities in our society. And then we have economic disaster, particularly for, you know, low and middle income Americans losing their jobs, their livelihoods. So given all of this, it's a triple blow to our democracy and to our society. And we do need good leadership to bring us out of this.
It seems as though, in addition to advising protesters to wear masks and as much as possible practice social distancing while protesting, it would behoove us to advise our police departments to stop spraying tear gas, particularly when there are peaceful protests, as we saw in Washington, D.C., not far, I'm assuming, from where you are, where on Monday, Trump and William Barr directed the use of tear gas on peaceful protesters in Lafayette Square so that Trump could have a photo op. Well, the killing of George Floyd and the protests that it sparked came soon after the U.S. passed the 100,000 mark. That's 100,000 people killed by COVID-19. That grim milestone, how does that fit within the projections that the government had made just a few months earlier? We saw the maps and the graphs that Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Deborah Birx showed in front of Trump, where we were expecting, you know, hundreds of thousands of American deaths, and they were warning us to follow social distancing and quarantine. So was the 100,000 number expected or higher than you had expected?
Well, you know, the models were all over the place and they kept changing, including the White House models, which relied very much on the University of Washington's data and monitoring. The truth is that I've seen White House figures that suggested that the figure would be well below 100,000. And the figures that were put forward by the White House of numbers in the hundreds of thousands were only if we didn't have social distancing. But we've had, you know, a lockdown where three out of four Americans have been in some form of shelter-in-place order or stay-at-home order. And still, we have over 100,000 deaths. And I think we must assume that, you know, if it's 100,000 reported deaths, it's many, many times, much higher number of actual deaths from COVID. My assumption is that it would be at least 50% greater. So it would not surprise me if COVID's caused 150,000 deaths. And remember, we're just at the beginning of this. You know, we're just at first base. You know, we could easily see many more cases and deaths in this first wave, and then we may have second and third waves. And I'm particularly worried about the fall and the winter, when we will have the dual pandemics of COVID and seasonal influenza. So we could have our hospitals overrun again. And of course, with these protests, we may now see that exacerbated. So there is a lot for us to think about, a lot for us to worry about and to plan for. We can't be complacent now.
There are, of course, workers that have been forced back to work or risk losing their unemployment benefits and jobs because states have reopened. As an expert in this field, would you have advised states to reopen? I mean, we certainly can't keep closed for more than a few months, because it's true, the economy does come to a standstill. So do you advise, are you okay with the openings and with the protections that states have put in place for the openings, which are, of course, patchwork?
Yeah, it's all over the place. But first, let me address your initial point about forcing people back to work in unsafe conditions. I think this is unethical. If you think about, the enormous risks that essential workers have, think about the meatpacking plants, and to kind of send somebody to work in a dangerous circumstance is just unethical. It also reminds me of another big issue with COVID-19 that's whipping America up, which is voting. You know, we're in a voting season, primary, and then we will be in November for a major election. And we shouldn't, just like workers shouldn't have to face the choice of, you know, my livelihood or my health or my life. People shouldn't have to worry about their, you know, their undertaking their civic responsibility to vote by putting themselves and their families at risk. You know, there are ways we can really significantly mitigate these risks, but we don't. So in answer to your second question, we are all over the place. Some states have gone slow and steady and have really monitored it and used clear criteria for reopening and then done so cautiously. Others have just, you know, just returned to work without the conditions being present. And the United States is, you know, it's not like other countries, say in Asia, where we're having uniform compliance with all of the things we know we need, you know, staying apart, disinfecting, universal mask use, all of the things that we know can significantly reduce the risk of transmission.
And speaking of Asia, I mean, there's a case of Hong Kong, which is really interesting. This is an area, the city that has been racked with many, many, many months of protests. The protests are now continuing. There's a new, you know, sedition law that China has imposed. Hong Kong has been very strict about mask wearing, but it's an extremely densely populated city, and protests have continued, and they've only had a handful of deaths attributed to COVID. Is Hong Kong an example of being able to exercise one's civic duty and one's right to free expression and still remain safe?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there is, you know, there are ways to remain safe in the COVID world, even if you're protesting. If you can stay separate and apart, if you can wear masks. But there is one thing that sometimes gets lost in the public conversation about protests is that there is one saving grace, and that's that these protests are outdoors. And we know that in outdoor spaces aren't so far been responsible for major clusters of cases. Most of the cases we're having follows a simple rule. I've used this rule of thumb. I think it's very useful for your audience to think about this. You know, the risk goes up with the following conditions. If you're indoors, if there are a number of people indoors, that is the density of the indoor space, and the duration where you're in that space with others. And so we do with COVID and the protests, they're outdoors, so that's a good thing. If they were wearing masks and distancing themselves and probably gloves, I would feel a lot better. I'd also feel a lot better if peaceful protests were allowed to go ahead without police using tear gas and certainly not any kind of physical force or physical presence. You know, I know the president's talked about the military, which I think would be outrageous in a democracy like ours.
So outdoors is a safer, and this is one of the things that we're learning from the research. I mean, it's hard to sort through the research if you're, you know, not somebody who's a scientist and who's steeped in this issue. But then for the general public, it seems even more complicated given how much misinformation is out there spreading on social media. But certainly we've seen that the so-called super spreader events, there was recently a study pointing out that something like 80% of all infections came from 20% of people through these super spreader events that were largely these indoor events, for example, in churches or big groups where they're singing, any place where there's speech. And because when we talk, sing, or speak loudly, we expel droplets that can carry our words. One of the things that has been disturbing me looking at the images of the masks or at videos of masks, masked protesters, is that when people start to speak, they take their mask off in order to speak. And that's, of course, besides the point, that's precisely when we need to be wearing a mask, right? When we're speaking or shouting.
Yes, in particular, you should be wearing a mask all the time when you're in public. But yes, if you cough, you sneeze, you talk, you sing, you yell, all of those things, can project virus out. And if you're in a densely packed place, you're not wearing a mask and you're shouting or singing, then the virus is projected out and everyone around you can be exposed to it. So those are, those are real risks, and we really, we need to have a well-governed society, and a well-governed society does allow protests, particularly for, this the social and racial injustice that we've seen in America. But it's also a well-governed society that makes sure that we can do, we can exercise our civic rights in the safest possible way. And right now, it's a bit of a chaos out there.
Now, it seems as though we've been sort of conducting this grand global experiment, right, of what's working, what's not working. There's the Hong Kong issue, then there's the New Zealand experiment, then there's Sweden. And Sweden has been in the news lately because this was a country, that is a democracy. It is a relatively healthy country, first world nation. And they chose a very different approach from other European nations, essentially having very few restrictions in place and relying on this concept of acquiring herd immunity by letting the virus spread. Now the scientist whose research or who has sort of led the charge on allowing Sweden to have this relatively open approach to the virus is admitting that he might have been wrong, and that even though, Sweden has had fewer deaths per capita than, say, the U.S., it has had more deaths per capita than it should have.
Yes, that's right. It has a lot more deaths per capita than its neighboring Nordic countries. I've always been worried about the Swedish example because when I've, as somebody who's worked in public health for, 30 years, herd immunity, or what's probably a better term, community immunity, is a term we use for vaccination. You don't expose a significant part of your population to a potentially dangerous virus as a method of getting to herd immunity. I've never been in favor of that. Boris Johnson in the UK had initially tried the same thing and then decided to lock down, but he locked down too late. And now the UK has one of the highest per capita death rates in the world. And Sweden is going up as well. So it is refreshing to see, an epidemiologist, a leader in Sweden, admitting error, because we don't see enough of that. And we do need humility when facing this virus, because there's so much we don't know. But it was a risk, and the risk has meant that there have been, preventable deaths in Sweden.
I'm wondering if you've seen the story that broke this week about how the World Health Organization and a number of governments around the world changed their COVID-19 policies and treatments based on flawed data or suspect data from this giant database that a small U.S. company called Surgisphere made available. And this database claimed to have obtained data from more than 1,000 hospitals worldwide. And now we're finding, even sort of was data that was deemed credible by The Lancet, the New England Journal of Medicine. And now all of that is coming under question, which just seems to me the worst possible kind of thing, given how desperately scientists are trying to find sound science on which to save our societies.
Yeah, I did see that. Large databases like that can be helpful, but that's why we need, the progress of science is through peer review, replication, and that we need to be very cautious before we jump to conclusions, particularly, as I mentioned, this is a very novel virus. We've never seen it before. There's so much that we don't know and we can't jump to conclusions. What I worry about is this, you know, the populist strong men leaders in the world, you know, Bolsonaro, Trump, Putin, Xi Jinping, you know, then it may well be that this will play into their narrative of, you know, oh, well, the scientists don't know what they're doing. But, you know, this is not something new. You know, if you look at, if you look at nutrition, scientific evidence or others, as soon as there's some study or some data, the press is saying, oh, dear, you know, we never know what scientists are really telling us. But the truth is you can know, but it takes time. It takes replication time to see if all the studies are pointing in the same direction. And so what our political leaders need to do is, you know, the most important thing in health communication is tell us what you know, tell us what you don't know, and tell us what you're trying to find out. Tell us what you're going to do to find out what you don't know. So I think that, yes, it is very troubling. And you know, science goes in fits and starts. You know, it's not always a clear line of upward knowledge and understanding. It needs to take time, and we're very, very early in this, both with our virology, our epidemiology, our clinical work with COVID. This is a very clever virus, and we're going to need to figure it out.
Right. Yeah. Some say, you know, the solution to bad science is better science, not throwing out the scientific work that's been done. And certainly, I believe the media does have some role to bear. As a person in the media, I also admit that there are times when you see the results of a study, and especially given how fast things were moving and how desperate people were for information, results were being shared before peer reviews were done, before formal publications happened. There was one story of results from, I believe it was Wuhan, where they were showing or finding that, or no, South Korea, where people were who had had the disease were apparently still infectious. They were finding that the COVID-19, they were getting reinfected. And we saw these headlines about, you know, getting the disease once doesn't mean that you're going to have immunity from it. Later, they found out that the tests were so sensitive, they were finding fragments of the dead virus in people's blood. But in the meantime, there were a lot of fear-mongering had taken place where people felt that, oh my goodness, if I've had this disease, I still may not get immunity. So do we know enough, or do you know enough about whether, you know, antibody tests are reliable, and having a positive result, does that mean that you can't get reinfected, et cetera?
Well, I can tell you what we know. First of all, the antibody tests now aren't ready for prime time because they're of a highly variable quality. And so right now, I think it would be unwise to rely on them whether you can go back to work and all of that.
So the rates of false negatives we know are high, but are the rates of false positives also too high?
No. Or are you talking about
antibody tests?
Antibody tests. Yeah, I mean, with antibody tests, most of our sensitivity and specificity analyses have been with actual antigen tests, you know, to see whether you've actually got the virus now.
Right.
The antibody tests, you know, there's so many, you know, they're of a variable quality, but this is what we do know. We believe that if you've had COVID, that for most people, they will develop what we call neutralizing antibodies. We believe that it will confer some protection against reinfection, but what we don't know is how much protection against reinfection, for how long that protection is. And also, the protection may vary from individual to individual, particularly when you've got Some people who've had severe disease with a very robust antibody response, and some with asymptomatic disease. So the bottom line is this. Having COVID and developing antibodies give you some level of protection? The answer is probably yes. Do we know how much protection and for how long? The answer to that is no.
And then finally, do you feel as optimistic as some of the Trump administration officials that we might have a vaccine by early next year?
That's the big question. You know, Putin just announced from Russia that he was planning to have a vaccine by September. And if you'll remember, Trump was also saying that we might have one a while back in the fall. That's completely unrealistic. Whether we're going to have something by early in the new year is literally unknown. Nobody can tell you that with any certainty because we do not have any definitive data that a vaccine is safe and effective. We've got some animal models, we've got some preliminary studies, but normally vaccine development takes up to 10 years.
Does the idea of developing one at warp speed, as Trump has said, concern you?
It concerns me greatly because I think it's possible that we will cut corners. First of all, one of the things that the president has done repeatedly, and this is an example of it, is basically overpromise and underdeliver. It's better to underpromise and overdeliver. So, to me, yes, it's possible we might have one by the first quarter of 2021, but we don't know that for sure. And even if we do, there won't be enough doses for the entire population. It'll probably be some scarcity. First responders will probably have first priority for the vaccine. But all in all, I worry that we might cut corners and we might it might affect safety and effectiveness because vaccines, remember, we're giving them to otherwise healthy people and they can have adverse consequences. Sometimes they can make the disease even worse or they can have side effects. President Ford actually lost his presidency over a flawed campaign for influenza vaccination when we had a novel influenza and it was thought to cause Guillain-Barré disease, chronic fatigue syndrome. So we have to be very careful. Luckily,
right, already there is too much public skepticism over the tried and tested vaccines for things like measles and mumps.
Yeah. I mean, I really worry about the anti-vaccine movement because, you know, right now we've got a double whammy. First of all, with COVID, childhood and other vaccines are going down. A lot of people aren't getting them because they're not going to school, they're not going to their clinics and things like that. So we've seen a big drop in the number of just basic routine vaccines. That's the first thing. And the second is that there are polls that show that one out of every four Americans would not get the COVID vaccine, and even a much larger number say that they would wait for a while and then make the decision. And so we need, if we are going to get herd immunity, we're going to need widespread coverage for the COVID vaccine. And by the way, I believe we need to double down on our efforts to have wide coverage of influenza vaccine this fall and winter, because otherwise we could overrun our hospitals when we have these dual epidemics.
Well, Professor Gostin, I have 100 more questions for you, but I know you're a busy man. I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it. Take care.
My guest has been Professor Lawrence Augustin. He is a university professor at Georgetown University, where he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health. Law. He's also the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law, where he's served in numerous high-level capacities. We've been discussing the latest on the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.